y'all to open up to Song of Solomon chapter 4, and we'll read a few verses there to start out with. Like Ryan said, my name is Ron Giese. I'm the pastor of leadership development here and also the administrative pastor, kind of over the staff and the operations of the church. Song of Solomon chapter 4 is a description of the lady, the maiden. Once or twice I might call her the Shulamite. That's not her name. We don't know her name, but that's one thing that she's called in the book. Verse 1, how beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes which have come up after their washing, all of which bear twins. Not one among them is lost to their young. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your temples are like a slice of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones on which are hung 1,000 shields, all the round shields of the mighty men. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle which feed among the lilies. Until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. About 30 years ago, there's a guy who was studying the Song of Solomon, and he got together with a cartoonist and decided he would come up with a picture of what this lady would look like if we took all of these pictures literally and not figuratively. And I remember seeing that 20, 30 years ago and thought, that is great. That's a good intro to the whole book. So right now what we'll do is look at that on the side screens, what that would have looked like. By the way, for those of you with more creative imaginations, the thing coming out of the lady's mouth is not a penis. It is her tongue, which drips honey. So not that that thought ever occurred to me, even for a few seconds. I'm just saying, if that occurs to you, no, it's not some weird inversion of oral sex. That's just her tongue dripping honey. That's just a very attractive thing to the man. To give you just one element of these five or six things, her hair, to us that sounds like an insult, doesn't it? Somebody's hair is like a bunch of goats. But keep in mind, this is goats that are seen from a distance. So what's happening here is they're goats with black hair. You know that goats have very short hair on their skin, and the sun shimmers and shines off of it. They're descending down a hill, and so there's kind of a wave going on here too. Maybe the closest thing I can think of is pictures, not still pictures, but film that you might have seen of a field of wheat or grain in the Midwest somewhere, when the wind is just lightly blowing on it, and it's all kind of the same height, and you know, it's in, you know, the grain is has come to fruition and it's about to be harvested. From a distance, not close up, that's a thing of beauty, because the sun's reflecting off of it, it's curly, and it's kind of waving a little bit. So this is what the guy is saying: man, I'm so attracted to the hair flowing down from your head, the way the sun shines off of it, the way that it's curled. I just want to kind of sink my hands into it, my nose, my face. I'm very attracted to that part of you. So it's really the opposite of what we think of if we think of a goat. So at the end of my talk, I'll encourage you guys who are married, use some of these lyrics if you understand them, and maybe explain some of them before you use them to your wife. Or come up with some modern-day ones of your own. Not that you're writing scripture, but writing something that is along the same lines, a compliment to your wife, using word pictures. Word pictures are really what the song is about, and there's so many throughout the whole Song of Solomon that we'll either use these to enter into a heavenly country, this great creative world that the author writes about, or we'll stumble over them. And so studying at least a few of these pictures will help us greatly to understand what this is about. So if you look at your notes, you may want to open up there. This is what Othmar Kiel, or actually some lines that he uses before what I'll quote. He says under your point number one, the song is a world of myrrh and frankincense, pomegranates and dates, ivories, lotus flowers, gazelles and doves and lions. Now, how many of those elements are in our world? Not many. A few of them, maybe if we go to a zoo. So this is a world that is foreign to us, but that's part of what I think is mysterious and attractive and compelling about reading the book. It's not walking down Central in downtown Albuquerque and giving us images from our world. But it makes it a little bit difficult as well. So what I want to do now is maybe give you one example. I've given you a brief one already, the goats coming down the hill. But let's look at one a little bit more in depth. Turn to chapter 8 in Song of Solomon. And look at verse 6. This is the lady speaking, and she says this, just at the beginning of verse 6. Put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. So our question here is, as we just get used to this idea of a world of pictures, what does she mean by a seal? So in the ancient Near East, which, to define that, is going to be, let me do it from your perspective, way to the east, modern-day Iran, Iraq, ancient Near East, Assyria, then Babylon. Way to the west, Egypt. Those are kind of the two poles, so to speak, of the ancient Near East. When one is up, the other tends to be down. And then when the other comes back up after a few centuries, they try to invade. Like if Babylon is up, they try to invade all the way into Egypt. Well, guess what's in the middle of those two? Israel. In fact, one person called Israel the land between, which is a phrase I love because it's right in between these two superpowers of the ancient Near East. So think of those three land areas or countries, and that's the ancient Near East. In that part of the world, there were two different kinds of seals. One is called a cylinder seal. So we'll look at a picture of that and look at the size of that up on the side screens. It's kind of small. You can tell it's just about an inch, inch and a half long. It's got writing on it, often pictures as well. Shaped, as you would guess, in the form of a cylinder, but there's a hole drilled through the cylinder lengthwise, and a piece of string or a thin piece of leather was put through that, tied, and then worn around the neck. This is of a man. Let's look at another slide and see what it's used for. What a guy would do is take this off of his neck, put it into wet or damp clay, roll it, and what came out was a rectangular-shaped impression on the clay, both picture and often words or text. In fact, we'll see a couple of these. This one's from Mesopotamia, again, modern-day Iran and Iraq, that far east of the two poles. This functioned as the guy's signature. So all of these were made out of semi-precious or sometimes precious stones. It's really neat to look at them online or in a book that has full color because some are green, some are red, the stone, some are blue. And they were obviously handmade, completely unique. There's no mass production, no duplicate of these things. So this one might have the guy's name on it, his title. It was usually more wealthy people or people in the court that would have these things. And it might explain, I'm the king's officer over this particular part of the kingdom. Why were they put on clay? Because outside of Egypt, where they used papyrus, the whole rest of the ancient Near East used clay to write on, not paper. So when a contract is drawn up, a scribe, someone who's literate, 95% of people were not literate, could not read or write. Someone who is literate, we would think of maybe a lawyer, would come along, write on the clay, and then ask the person making the contract or covenant to ratify it by taking the cylinder seal off of his neck, rolling it on the wet clay. That way, months, years down the road, they're going to fire harden the clay so that it's just like a piece of rock. No one could question, did he really sign that? Was he really there? Did he really approve of this contract? Of course he did. His seal is there. He always has his seal, would never depart or leave it, forget it somewhere. Possibly a man's most prized possession of all that he would own. Let's look at another slide. There was a second kind of seal in the ancient Near East, and that was a ring or a signet ring. These were actually more common in Israel than the cylinder seals. They have found several thousand signet rings or impressions of a ring in clay and just maybe a few hundred cylinder seals in Israel. But in Mesopotamia, it's the opposite, a whole lot of cylinder seals. This actually is a Roman ring here. Let's look at an Israelite one, though. This is actually not the stone itself, but clay that has lasted through thousands of years because it's hardened. The impression that a signet ring made. This is only writing, only Hebrew, no pictures. And it says, Baruch ben Neriah, which is two proper names. Baruch, the son of Neriah. And then it has a third line, the bottom piece of writing, and that says the scribe. Well, guess what? There is a Baruch, son of Neriah, the scribe, in the Bible. It's in the book of Jeremiah, and this is Jeremiah's scribe. So we know he was a real guy from history, because we've got not so much his stone, but something just as good, the impression his stone made in clay. Let's look at another one. We'll go through the next three kind of quick. Here's one of Hosea, which has a picture of him. Maybe the prophet, maybe not, because there were several people named Hosea. Next after this is another figure from the Bible, and there weren't too many people with this name. This is Jezebel. There are Hebrew letters scattered about this that has her name. It even has the look of Egyptian gods and goddesses, so kind of appropriate for Jezebel to have some pagan gods or goddesses on her signet ring. Most of them were owned by men, but apparently some were owned by women as well. And then next after this, we have Jeroboam II, that we call the second, but this does have the King Jeroboam written in Hebrew on this with lion, the seal of the tribe of Judah. And so this is Jeroboam's seal right here. So what does this all mean? We know what a seal is. There's only one. It's a man's most prized possession. It's really his identity. It represents him. So when the lady says in chapter 8, wear me as a seal over your heart or on your arm, she probably means this. I want to be the only one in your life. I need to be unique in your life. I want to be owned by you. And in the song, there's really an equality. He owns her, she owns him. Much like what Paul talked about in the epistles. So she says, I want to be unique. I want to be owned by you, your identity, and I want to be over your heart at all times. In Hebrew, you think and reason and meditate with your heart, not your head or your brain. Think of Proverbs 3, verse 5. Trust in the Lord with all of your, what's the word? Heart. Here's the second line. Do not lean on your own understanding. Those are parallel. Understanding is parallel to heart. It's not saying feel with your heart and think and understand with your mind. They're both the same thing. So she's saying, in addition to wanting to be unique in his identity, she is saying, I want to be in your thoughts always, always over your heart. The arm in Hebrew usually indicates strength. God's strong right arm takes the Israelites out of Egypt. His strength does that for them. So she's also saying something about wanting to be his strength or maybe a source of his strength. So it's a great picture if you understand what seals were for in the ancient Near East. These were not like gasket seals on an engine, nothing like black rubber in the form of an O-ring to help seal in oil and seal out, you know, air and dirt and things like that. No, completely different kind of seal, which when you understand it, in part helps us learn about the monogamous nature of the whole book, that it's one man, one woman, actually one husband, one wife for one lifetime. Why? Because she wants to be a seal. There's only one seal, not mass-produced. The very purpose was this only goes to one man, and it has a picture associated with him, probably his name on it, kind of like a family crest maybe in the Middle Ages. and rings that were pressed into hot wax. Same idea. Now, this is not the strongest piece of evidence for monogamous marriage in this book, but it's one of, wow, 7 or 8 pieces of evidence. There are actually much more strong ones that this is a husband and wife only devoted to each other. But I think this is a neat one to add into the whole mix of this idea of one man, one woman, one lifetime. You can read the rest of that Othmar Kiel quote on your own. Let's go down to number 2, the title. So flip back to the beginning of the book, chapter 1, verse 1. Here's how Song of Solomon starts. The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. In the Hebrew Bible, the title does not have the name Solomon in it. Their title for this is The Song of Songs, which I actually like better than the Protestant title. The Song of Songs, and then that's it. In fact, Hebrew often takes the first word or two of a book and makes that the title of the book. So Genesis is not called Genesis or some counterpart of Genesis in Hebrew. It's In the Beginning. So Hebrew calls this the Song of Songs. What does that mean? Hebrew doesn't have a superlative, or better worded, it does the superlative different. So I know you guys don't want to think back to high school English grammar class or maybe elementary school, but I've got to ask you to do that for a minute. Superlative means the best part of good, better, best. It's the top of the progression, the climax, the most extreme of something. But Hebrew doesn't have the word best. I actually think it's got a neater way of doing the superlative because Hebrew takes maybe 6 or 7 different ways of doing the superlative, one of which is taking a noun, putting of after it, then repeating the noun in the plural, so add s on the end. So how do you say in that particular formula, the most excellent king of all the kings you can imagine, the best, the most fantastic, the most wise, the most powerful, the most sovereign? You would say in this formula, the King of Kings. How would you say God dwells in heaven, but man, it's not the air around us. It's not that blue sky that the birds fly in. It's way, way beyond that. You would say in this formula, God dwells in the heaven of heavens, meaning the farthest, highest heaven. And there's a verse that has that kind of formula. I won't go through the other ways, but that's one way of doing a superlative. So what does that mean here? It means this is the best song. It certainly means this is the best song of all the love songs you could come across. So if you can recite some lyrics of a love ballad you've heard on Top 40 radio better than you know the Song of Solomon, you're going in the wrong direction. Because that one on the radio is not the best love song of all the love songs written of all time periods of all people groups in history. This one is. It might mean the best song of all songs written of all genres and topics. But either way, certainly it means the first, either way, this beats out tens of thousands of other songs that have been written. And even beats out other songs in Scripture that are inspired and authoritative for life and practice. But at the very least, if you're thinking love, romance, marriage, sex, this is the place to go. That's what verse 1 declares. Look here, not elsewhere. How about the second part, which is Solomon's? This is tricky. This is really difficult. And it's difficult because there's a preposition before Solomon's name in Hebrew, which is very broad. Meaning it can mean different things. It's very, very common. Roughly, it means 2 or 4. So it's something like the Song of Songs, which is 2 or 4 Solomon. This can mean authorship. It might mean accredited to Solomon as the one who wrote it. That's what 4 might mean. It might mean dedicated to him. I tend to think it doesn't mean that. And it could mean somehow associated with him or belonging to him. Now keep in mind, even if it means authorship, he may not have written the whole thing. The book of Proverbs, I think Ryan pointed this out, starts with the fact that Solomon wrote it. But if you read through all of the book of Proverbs, not all of that's written by Solomon. There are pieces written by other authors. We know that. So all of that is to say, Hebrew is not as strict as we are with authorship. We're in this world of plagiarism and proper sources, and man, you're almost a criminal deserving of jail if you do a quote and don't footnote it. The world of the ancient Near East is nothing like that. You often don't quote people. In fact, it's an honor if you incorporate their words into your own, in your own teachings. You're doing them credit without having to footnote every time you reference someone. So let me tell you what I think that it means. I don't think that Solomon wrote the whole book. I don't think it means Solomon wrote this book. So I can't offer a strong opinion on this because we don't know, but let me give you a few things in passing, and this won't be long because it's not really why we're here for some detailed debate on authorship. But you may want to write these down quickly. Number one, there's no first-person pronouns that mean something like I, where we know that it's Solomon speaking. So in other words, there's no verse we can find where the author says something like, I have a vast domain and I'm king over a large part of the earth and many riches and men that can fight for me, but you're the one that I love. We don't have something where we know it's Solomon. He's speaking in the first person and he's talking to her. There aren't very many first person pronouns in the whole book. Compare that with Ecclesiastes, the book before this, which seems to be written by Solomon, and there's I all over the place. And you can easily imagine that he as king investigated this way of finding happiness and found it to be failing, because he's got the resources to do that. So not a lot of I pronouns here where we know it's Solomon. That's not a very strong piece of evidence. Number two, though, the marriage in Song of Solomon is clearly monogamous. One husband, one wife, married for a lifetime. And this is not Solomon, and we really got to kind of maybe squeeze and twist and force fit his life to make it fit that. We read in 1 Kings chapter 11 that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. And this was really throughout most of his life. So people that say that he wrote the whole book, it's definitely written by Solomon, he's the lover, the man in the whole book, have to find some part of Solomon's life where it fits that he could have had just one love. And so they usually go back to the beginning. They'll say that early in his reign, when he first became king, before his heart got pulled aside by other women and political alliances, he had one love. And this is the story of that one love. Now, that's possible. I'm not discounting it as impossible. I just don't think it's likely. Especially since, we'll look at this verse a little bit later, in chapter 6 of Song of Solomon, we read about many queens and concubines. Now, queens means that they're married to a king. They're not called the queens of Babylon or the queens of Egypt. And in fact, they're close enough to the lady of the Song of Solomon to praise her. So I think it's natural to think that these are the queens, plural, of the king of Israel at the time of the Song of Solomon. And who is that? Solomon himself. So it's a little hard to work with some of the verses in chapter 6 about this harem that the king of Israel has if Solomon is the lover who's proclaiming that you're the only one for me. It's hard to reconcile those two. Finally, number three, why do I not think that Solomon wrote the whole book? Solomon's only mentioned in detail twice, once in chapter 3 at the end, and then once in chapter 8 at the end. Chapter 3, so he's barely mentioned in the book, really. In chapter 3 at the end, it's his wedding that we're reading about. Now, this may be the wedding of the maiden, the lady, the Shulamite in the book. And maybe she's picturing her wedding as similar to the one that Solomon had. But there's no verses at the end of chapter 3 that tell us this is actually the lady of the Song of Solomon that's getting married to Solomon. We're simply reading about Solomon's wedding. And in chapter 8, This is actually a little bit derogatory about Solomon. We'll look at that in a few minutes and read those verses. Chapter 8 is all about a business Solomon has where he's got this vast, vast, vast vineyard that brings in the equivalent of probably hundreds of thousands of dollars a year because of its produce. And that's actually looked down upon, I think, by the lady of the Song of Solomon. Not praised, but we'll look at that in a few minutes. It is true, if you look at chapter 1, verse 4, it is true that the lady of the song calls her lover the king. Verse 4 of chapter 1, draw me after you and let us run together. The king has brought me into his chambers. I don't think this king is Solomon, though. I think it's her lover, which is a commoner. I think both the lady and the man are not royalty. This is a love term she has for her lover, one of many, when she calls him her king. She also calls him her shepherd. That's done in verse 7, just a few verses after verse 4 of chapter 1. So she calls him a king. She calls him a shepherd. He, by the way, calls her his sister. Another word picture that's very foreign to us, even odd. But that probably means a term of endearment where she's his best friend and really contributes in a neat way to this idea that in this book, love is so much more than sex. So he calls her his sister. He also calls her, in chapter 7, verse 1, the daughter of princes. Well, is she royalty? I think not. But this is a love term he has for her. You're a princess. In my heart, in my mind, in my way of thinking. All right, we need to move past this whole authorship deal. So next in your notes, and we can go through this kind of quickly, this is what makes the song kind of difficult to read or interpret or understand. Speakers are really not identified, or usually they're not identified. And this is actually very common of Hebrew poetry. Let me give you just one example. Look at Psalm chapter 2. So this means flipping back several books to the book of Psalms, way back to the beginning of the book of Psalms, the second psalm. Let me start at verse 4. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Verse 5, then he will speak to them in his anger, terrify them in his fury, saying, so who's going to speak in verse 6? The Lord. Maybe we'd say God the Father. The Lord is speaking in verse 6. As for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. But now look at verse 7. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. That's a different speaker, isn't it? That can't be the Lord himself. That's somebody else speaking of the Lord saying, you're calling me your son. But we didn't get introduced to a different speaker. That's the point. Now verse 8. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, the very ends of the earth as your possession. That sounds like it's back to the Lord or God the Father who's speaking to the Son saying, I'll give you the nations as your inheritance. So you've had two changes in speaker here. And unlike the way you and I would write, no indication of that, no clear marker, I should say. Something like the Lord said, and then the Son said, double quote marks. Hebrew, by the way, doesn't have double quote marks. This happens all over the place in Song of Solomon. So I'm guessing many of your Bibles actually will insert something like the man or the shepherd or the king, and then the lady or the maiden or the Shulamite, then maybe the daughters of Jerusalem to help you navigate through these different speakers. So just know that if you haven't studied it in depth, speakers are going to change without any indication. And after a verse or two, you'll think, oh, this is from the guy's point of view here. It can't be from the lady's point of view. I've gone through a switch. Number 4 in your notes. This is one of the most important keys to understanding and reading the song. Look for pictures, word pictures, or strings of words that form a picture that get repeated. So here's my favorite. And it'll actually dovetail back into this idea of who Solomon is in the song. The vineyard in the song indicates the woman herself, her body. And this picture of a vineyard gets repeated and actually bookends the Song of Solomon, meaning it's at the beginning and then it gets repeated back at the end. So chapter 1, let's look at verse 6. The woman says, "Do not stare at me because I am swarthy. The sun has burned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me caretakers of the vineyards." There it's literal. "But I have not taken care of my own vineyard." There it's figurative. So she's probably looking back to a time when she was busy with the family business, but had not taken care of herself, had not prepared herself yet for marriage. She's not taking care of her own body, and she'll start thinking and praying along those lines. Skip to chapter 8, verse 11. Here we've got the picture of a vineyard again. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He entrusted the vineyard to caretakers. Each one was to bring 1,000 shekels of silver for its fruit. But then the beginning of verse 12 really stands out as different, although using the same word, vineyard, than verse 11, because the speaker says, "My very own vineyard is at my disposal." And then after that line, we're back to the idea of verse 11. Solomon's vineyard is a business. "The 1,000 shekels are for you, Solomon, and 200 are for those who take care of its fruit." Here's what I think is happening, and I've tried to indicate this by taking that one line in your notes, indenting it, and then putting a line space before and after it. This is the lady speaking. She's talking about Solomon's business, his wealth, how rich he is, this vast vineyard that he has that brings in so much money. And in the middle of that, she says, by way of contrast, "I mean, you own this vineyard, you've bought it, you pay for it, it's all a matter of money to you." In the middle of that, sandwiched in, is her statement saying, "My own vineyard," meaning my body, "belongs to me and me alone. It is before me. It's not for sale. It's not part of some big vineyard. It belongs to me." And of course, she's going to give it to her lover, the man of the Song of Solomon. Here's how one person translated it, Marcia Falk, in her translation, which is a loose translation. It's like a paraphrase, but here's how she takes these two verses. "The king has a vineyard whose fruit is worth silver," meaning he sells it. He gets money for it. "The king has a vineyard whose fruit is worth silver. I have a vineyard. Its fruit is my own. Have your wealth, Solomon. Keep all your vineyards, whose yield you must share with your watchmen and guards." I really like that. I think it captures what's happening here. There's a little bit of a backdoor critique against Solomon and his wealth. In fact, back up at verse 7, if you read that later on your own, it's clear that in verse 7 of chapter 8, the author wants to make the point that money can't buy love. It's not a business. In fact, I think there may be a second meaning to Solomon's vineyard, the first being that he probably had a real vast vineyard that brought in lots of money. However, if vineyard is a picture for a woman's body in the Song of Solomon, then Solomon having a vast vineyard could easily indicate his harem, which he had, according to 1 Kings. And it might be reinforced by this name, Baal Hamon. There is no Baal Hamon. We don't know of any city or village by that name. So many commentators think, and I think they're right, that this is a made-up name, a figurative name. It means, Baal means lord or boss. Hamon means a crowd, often a crowd that's kind of tumultuous, a little bit chaotic. So this would be a great title if indeed there's the second meaning of the vineyard being Solomon's wives and concubines, because he's boss over this crowd, which you could only imagine some of the competition among many wives and mistresses. So there's this tumultuous crowd that he has to reign over, and it's really a business. Many of them are married because of political alliances. Others are purchased because of their beauty. And so I think the maiden is saying, "This is your business. You stay in your world. My vineyard is now before me. It's full grown. It's come to fruition. And I give it to one lover, the person that she wants to be as a seal upon his heart, which we saw earlier in chapter 8. Let me give you just a few other examples. You can look at these maybe later on your own. I won't spend 5 minutes with each one of these, but rather point them out. A few other examples of pictures that get repeated are the lady bringing the lover, her husband, into her mother's house. Again, that sounds kind of odd for us, and into the bedroom of her mother. We usually wouldn't think of that as a great place to have a liaison, a sexual encounter, the bedroom of my wife's mother. But, and again, I won't spend 5 minutes on it, there are neat positive associations with this as a picture for them. That occurs twice. Three times, the man is pictured as a gazelle or a young stag leaping and bounding on a mountain. So she looks at his energy and his beauty, his handsome appearance, and describes him as a gazelle or young stag. That occurs three times. And then the most important repetition in the book, which I'm guessing either Dave or Ryan, maybe even both, will mention, so I'll just point it out to you, is this refrain, "Do not arouse or awaken love until it pleases," which, like Ryan said, occurs three times, and is another part of this monogamous, sex is in marriage only, teaching of the book. Number five in your notes, is this about a maiden, a shepherd, and a king? Is it about all three, or is it about two? Well, there are actually four different views here, and I'm just going to go through them rather quickly. Under the two-person view, some people think this is about Solomon and his bride, meaning the whole book, in the whole book, the man is Solomon himself, the king of Israel. I've already told you why. Really kind of draw back from that. One of the reasons being, Solomon was known for many wives, and we'd have to kind of find some time in his life where he doesn't have all these wives and can commit himself to one and only one. Of course, if that happened, if we went back early in Solomon's life and said he is the author and the lover in Song of Solomon, not that great of a book as a role model for us, because he gave up on that one man, one woman, one lifetime thing pretty quick, according to 1 Kings. But that's one view. A second view, B, is that this has nothing to do with Solomon and that it's about a shepherd and his bride. Only two characters, both commoners, neither royalty. There's a three-person view, letter C, that it is about a shepherd and his bride, but Solomon is another suitor in competition for the lady. And there are various subsets within this view. But in this view, there are three characters, all equally a part of the song, and eventually the woman chooses the shepherd boy, the commoner. D, which is the one I like the best, says that the book is about a husband and wife, and they're actually married through the whole book because each chapter has some kind of intimate associations between the two. But why the half person? Because Solomon is referred to more than just in passing, but he's not a main character. He's not a suitor, a competitor for the affection, the heart of the woman. He is king of Israel at that time, and he's looked to at two different places. Again, end of chapter 3, end of chapter 8. But I think more looked to by way of contrast and critique than by way of compliment and admiration. Keep in mind, Solomon is known for three things. They all start with W, so it's not that hard to remember. And I've put verse references in your notes. He's definitely known for wisdom. Those of you who have been around the Bible for a number of years will know that when Solomon became king, God said, "Ask for one thing." Solomon asked for wisdom. God granted it. And we see that wisdom reflected in Ecclesiastes, in Proverbs, in many parts of the written Bible. However, he's also known for wealth. Is that good or bad? Well, neither. In his case, it ended up being a little bit bad. In fact, David and Solomon's era was known as the Golden Age and still is to this day. Why? Because they had more territory, they captured more land mass between father and son than at any time before David became king, nor any time after Solomon's death. You'll remember after Solomon died, the kingdom divided. North, south, each had its own king. Even if you had combined at any point after Solomon's death, the territory of the north and the territory of the south that wasn't anywhere close to the land that Solomon had acquired. Modern-day Israel is nowhere close to what God granted the people of Israel under the reign of King Solomon. Third, and this is most unfortunate of all, Solomon was known for many women. And the verse reference there is 1 Kings chapter 11, the first few verses. And we read after those verses, by the way, that this extremely displeased God. He was very angry, very upset at Solomon because Solomon sinned, rebelled in a very significant way against God's instructions by doing this. So God in no way was like, oh, you've got a few too many. It's a little bit of a sin, but not a big one. No. This was in direct disobedience to God. So one more, and then we'll kind of start wrapping it up for this first session. One more instance of a word or a phrase that gets repeated. So Song of Solomon, actually like every biblical book, is a great book to pull out a pencil, a highlighter, a pen, and do some circles and underlines. This is the phrase, "Who is this?" And it first appears in chapter 3. So look back there. And we'll start at verse 6. By the way, the "this" part of "who is this" in Hebrew is feminine. So we know that it's a lady that's being talked about. In English, that's not clear. If you look at chapter 3, verse 6, "who is this coming up from the wilderness?" Maybe it's Solomon himself. Maybe it's the litter, the chair, the throne that's set up and carried by men. That has someone sitting inside of it. Or maybe it's the bride. Well, let me tell you, it's the bride. In fact, I don't like New American Standard here because New American Standard, the version I'm looking at and use, has "what is this?" Hebrew clearly has "who" for the first word, and the "this" is clearly feminine. So you've got this lady coming up out of the wilderness, but as you read through these verses at the end of chapter 3, it's really not so much about the lady. It's about the riches of the litter that she's being carried on. There's gold, there's inlaid stones, vast amount taken to handcraft this thing that she rides on. Again, I think it's part of this backdoor critique, or it could be positive. It could be the maiden thinking of the royal, beautiful wedding of Solomon and how hers was like that. Maybe a little bit like years ago, some of you are too young to remember this, but years ago, Prince Charles and Princess Diana get married, and we watched their wedding. Now, of course, we know all the bad things that happened after that. But for that moment, it was kind of like, yeah, my wedding was like that. Well, it really wasn't, you know. But in my imagination, it was like, yeah, Carla was beautiful, and she had this gorgeous dress on, and we were in this holy, sacred setting, and our best friends, our courtiers were there with us. So, you know, it really wasn't that elegant, but in my imagination, it was like, yeah, that wedding day was so glorious, so wonderful. It may be like that. So it may be her envisioning her wedding. But what I see here is a lot about riches. Here's what's more interesting than chapter 3, though. Let's track the other two times this term occurs, or this phrase. Chapter 6, verse 10 also has, "who is this?" And a few verses before chapter 6, verse 9, we read in verse 8 about the 60 queens and 80 concubines, maidens without number. Well, again, we see the queens also mentioned, by the way, at the end of verse 9. Who's the king that these queens are married to? I think that it's Solomon. So he's got this harem, and we know that if he's going to have a harem on this scale of 1 to 10, they're all going to be a 10. They're going to be just gorgeous women in terms of their figure and their age and all that kind of stuff from the world's point of view. But even these ladies in verse 9 say, "Who is this?" Looking at the maiden, the lady of the Song of Solomon, "that grows like the dawn, as beautiful as the full moon, as pure as the sun, as awesome as an army with banners." Even they look at this, what I think is a commoner, and say, "She's more beautiful than we are." So again, I think a contrast here. And then finally, the final example of who is this coming up, which actually repeats the chapter 3, who is coming up from the desert, in chapter 8, verse 5. Here, I think, is a real contrast between the lady of the Song of Solomon and the bride of Solomon in chapter 3. Because look at the line after that in verse 5. Verse 5 of chapter 8. Who is this coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved? What did the bride of chapter 3 lean on? She leaned on a very expensive litter or portable chair or throne made of gold, of precious stones. She leaned against wealth. This is the maiden. It's clear the maiden, the lady, the Shulamite, talking in chapter 8, through most of chapter 8. And what is being said here of what she leans on? She leans only on her beloved, only on her husband. So again, I think a contrast is being set up there. It's maybe not the easiest thing to see, but I think in the context it's there. Finally, your point number 6 is really more a note in passing. Are some of these sections in the Song of Solomon real or imaginary? You can ask that of chapter 3, especially of chapter 5, which begins with the lady saying, I was asleep, but you know what? I was awake at the same time. Is she dreaming? Is it real and historic? Is it imaginary? Let me share with you, I don't think this is a question Israelites would ask. And we really don't ask it of most poetry. Now, I think this is a true story. I don't think it's a fictitious tale. But we're really not supposed to ask so much sleep, awake, dream. We're supposed to read and enter into the word pictures and images. Feel them, experience them in our hearts. And even, like I suggested at the beginning, use these lyrics in our own lives, in our own love making, in our own love declarations as one spouse to another. So let me pray with you guys, and then I'll give you some more instructions about the morning. God, our Father, we thank you for inspiring these words. Not just inspiring these words, but calling this the song of all songs. The best, the most excellent song that there is. God, help us not to be embarrassed or ashamed, especially between a married man and woman, of what you are not ashamed to declare to us in writing. We thank you for this book. Help us to learn more about it. And may your Holy Spirit change our lives through what we learn, and not just our heads with more facts throughout the course of this morning. We thank you for that great and glorious name of Jesus. Amen.